Hi, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today, we have a great show lined up for you. We will be talking to Johnny Bowden about inflammation in the first half of the show. And in the second half, we'll be talking to Maggie Moon, author of The Mind Diet, Preventing Alzheimer's and Dementia. But before that, here's Alan with the health news.
New research seems to confirm that stress lowers a woman's chances of becoming pregnant, particularly stress that occurs around the time of ovulation. Study author Kyra Taylor said if you're feeling more stressed than you usually do around ovulation time, you're 40% less likely to get pregnant that month. Taylor is an assistant professor of epidemiology and population health at the University of Louisville School of Public Health and Information Services. Taylor believes her team's study is the first to look at stress at different time periods in a woman's monthly cycle to determine if there are different effects at different points. In the study, the researchers evaluated 400 women aged 40 and younger. All were sexually active and not using contraception. Taylor said only about a third were actively trying to get pregnant, but all were having unprotected sex without birth control. On a daily basis, the women recorded their stress levels from 1, the lowest, to 4, the highest. They did so for up to 20 cycles or until pregnancy occurred. On average, the women recorded their stress for 8 cycles. The study was published online recently in the Annals of Epidemiology. Smoking cigarettes can leave a lasting imprint on human DNA, altering more than 7,000 genes in ways that may contribute to the development of smoking-related diseases, a new study says. Reviewing results from blood samples taken from nearly 16,000 people in 16 prior studies, the researchers also found that for those who stopped smoking, most genes recovered within 5 years of quitting. Study author Dr. Stephanie London said although this emphasizes the long-term residual effects of smoking, the good news is the sooner you can stop smoking, the better off you are. London is the deputy chief of the epidemiology branch of the U.S. National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Even so, London's team found that some genetic changes remained, even 30 years after quitting smoking. London and her colleagues zeroed in on a process called DNA methylation, genetic changes that don't alter genes' underlying code, but can change how they're expressed or turned on. The study was published September 20th in the journal Circulation, Cardiovascular Genetics. Light therapy, commonly used to treat seasonal depression, may restore a measure of libido to men who struggle with a low sex drive, a small study suggests. Italian researchers said they found that men exposed to just 2 weeks of daily doses of bright light saw their testosterone levels increase more than 50% and their sexual satisfaction levels more than triple. Study author Dr. Andrea Fagiolini said they were not surprised to observe those results. He is chairman of both the Department of Mental Health and the School of Specialization in Psychiatry at the University of Siena. Fagiolini said that his team's lightbox experiment took its cue from nature. Prior investigations, conducted by his team and other researchers, have found that both sexual interest and testosterone levels naturally grow up in tandem during spring and summer. Fagiolini said that in the Northern Hemisphere, men typically see their testosterone levels fall off between November and April before beginning a gradual climb back up during the summer. Fagiolini and his colleagues reported their findings recently at a meeting of the European College of Neuropsychopharmacology in Vienna, Austria. Man's best friend may also be a college student's best buddy, new research suggests. The study found that dog therapy can ease homesickness in first-year college students and possibly reduce their risk of dropping out. Transitioning from high school to university can prove to be a challenge for many first-year students, John Tyler Binfitt, an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia, said in a news release. Given that students who experience homesickness are more likely than their non-homesick peers to drop out of university, he added, universities have a vested interest in supporting students during their first-year transition. Binfitt and his colleagues recruited 44 homesick first-year students. Half of that group went to 8 weekly dog therapy sessions, lasting 45 minutes. The students interacted with dogs and their handlers and fellow student participants. The other 22 homesick students didn't take part in dog therapy. They served as a control group for the study. After 8 weeks, students getting dog therapy said they were much less homesick and had significantly higher satisfaction with life. The study was published recently in the journal Anthrozoos.
Welcome, Johnny, nutritionist, psychologist, author of 14 books, including The Cholesterol Myth. We're going to talk today with Johnny about inflammation. You there, Johnny?
I am indeed. Thanks for having me. What a pleasure.
Thank you. We've heard that inflammation is the source of most disease. Is that true?
It's certainly a promoter of most diseases. It's an accompaniment to most diseases. And I couldn't help overhearing when you were doing the introductions that you're going to be talking about Alzheimer's in the second half of the show. And I'd love to start by pointing out that Alzheimer's is now being referred to as type 3 diabetes. So almost everything we're going to talk about in our segment is probably related to the next segment, because what we're finding out is that inflammation, insulin resistance, and all the things that accompany that actually are present in many different diseases. Heart disease and has a component of that. Diabetes, cancer, obesity, all of them could be considered inflammatory diseases. And when my friends who are MDs who do autopsies, when they look at the brains of Alzheimer's patients, guess what they see? Inflammation. Of course, they see other things as well, and nobody's saying that that's the only factor, but you can pretty much count on the fact that inflammation will make almost everything worse and accompanies just about every degenerative disease that we don't want to have, from diabetes, as I said, to heart disease, to obesity, to cancer, and even to being overweight.
Okay. How are high blood sugar and inflammation connected?
Well, indirectly, they're connected. And maybe we could just back up a second and talk a little bit about what inflammation is, and then I can show you how it kind of relates to all these other things. So most of us are familiar with inflammation in one of its two forms, and we think that's what it is. So if you get an abscess in your tooth, if you get a skin outbreak of acne or a big zit or something, or you stub your toe, you injure your back playing golf or something, it starts to get swollen and it hurts and it's inflamed, and we all know what that feels like. That's not what we're talking about.
So that's acute inflammation.
The first is called acute inflammation, and that's the one everybody's familiar with. That's the one when you bang your shin and, it gets all red, or you get a splinter in the area, it gets all swollen and inflamed, and that's acute inflammation. And as my friend Barry Sears, the author of the Zone books, says, acute inflammation hurts, but chronic inflammation kills. And chronic inflammation is what we're talking about. Chronic inflammation flies beneath the pain radar, much like high blood pressure, high triglycerides. It doesn't have any symptoms. Nobody goes to the doctor and says, God, my triglycerides are really hurting. Or, gee, I've got inflammation in my vascular system. No, because you don't feel that. It just does its damage under the hood. And when inflammation occurs in the vascular system, that's when you start to promote things like heart disease and other circulatory and vascular illnesses. So now the connection to high blood sugar is this. High blood sugar usually means that there is an issue with carbohydrate metabolism. Your blood sugar is going up too high. Insulin isn't being effectively, it's either not being produced enough or it's being produced plenty of it, but it's not getting to where it needs to get. So it's not doing its job of taking that sugar out of the bloodstream and getting it into the cells where it can be used for energy. That's what is supposed to happen. But when it doesn't happen, your blood sugar stays high and the pancreas is going, oh boy, we better shoot out some more insulin. So now you've got high blood sugar and high insulin, but if that insulin isn't doing its job, if it's not able to escort sugar into the cells, then you have a condition that's known as insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is at the heart of all of these diseases like diabetes and metabolic syndrome, and it's turning out as well to be part of Alzheimer's disease. You do not want to be insulin resistant. You want to be insulin sensitive. You want your cells, when insulin comes calling with its sugar payload and says, open up your door, cell, we've got some sugar for you to use as energy, you want those cells to be sensitive to that message, open up their doors and take that sugar in. When they don't, you've got a bad situation, because now you've got high blood sugar and high insulin, and you're about one step away from being diagnosed with diabetes.
What are some ways you can tell that you have insulin resistance?
Let me just tie that in with inflammation, and then we'll talk about the ways you can tell whether you have insulin resistance or not. So when you have a lot of insulin resistance, almost invariably, not all the time, because there are skinny diabetics, but they're in the minority. Generally, what goes with this whole syndrome is abdominal obesity and overweight. Most diabetics, 80% of diabetics or more, are overweight or obese. And so when you have that extra weight, you now have an inflammation factory. Because we used to believe that fat cells were just annoying. They just sat on your hips and your butts, and they made it difficult to put on your jeans, and everybody hated the way they looked with these fat cells. But we used to believe that's all they did, was make you very pissed off at how you looked in the mirror. We now know that those fat cells are little hormone factories. They are very active, and they push out, they spew out all kinds of inflammatory compounds like cytokines, and they cause even more inflammation. So the fat cells are your are factories for inflammatory compounds. So the connection between high blood sugar is generally the first step towards a progression of things that usually results in weight gain. And when you have weight gain, you have more inflammation. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So the inflammation comes from the extra weight that you're carrying.
More inflammatory compounds you have
yes.
in your body.
Which are from the little hormone factories.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Now, how do we know we have, what was the question, insulin resistance?
How do we know if our bodies are having insulin resistance? Is there ways we could tell?
Well, I have my own favorite way. There is a very clear medical way you can do it. With a blood test, you can measure your fasting insulin. And you often have to ask for that. Most doctors will just do your blood sugar, but you really want to know what's your fasting insulin, because it should be low. There's no food in the system. There should be no reason for insulin to be running around trying to get the sugar out of the bloodstream if you haven't eaten and there's not much sugar in there. So when you have high insulin, in fasting, that's not a good sign. It means it's not getting into the cells. It's not doing its job. But there's an easier way that you can do it at home without going to the doctor. I love this low-tech way of measuring insulin resistance.
Okay, let's hear it.
You ready for it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
You stand in front of a wall.
Okay.
Walk towards the wall.
Mm-hmm.
If your belly hits the wall before your nose, you got insulin resistance.
Perfect. Anybody can do that, eh?
Now, let me put a caveat on that. There are skinny diabetics. There are skinny people with insulin resistance. They are in the minority. It's not common, but it happens. So the fact that you say, I don't have any problems with that because I have no belly, so if I walk right towards the wall, my nose is going to hit it before the belly. Most of the time, that's pretty fine. But do be aware that there is a subclass of people who can be metabolically damaged and yet not be overweight.
Okay. So when we think of diabetes as related to high blood sugar, everybody gets that connection. But are there other diseases like heart disease or Alzheimer's also connected to the high blood sugar? Are there other diseases connected to having high blood sugar?
Absolutely. Heart disease, we now know absolutely high blood sugar and a high what we call a high glycemic diet, which is foods that convert to sugar quickly, absolutely is a risk factor for heart disease. We know that cancer cells only feed on one thing, sugar.
Sugar.
And we know that Alzheimer's is being called type 3 diabetes because of the connection to insulin and blood sugar. You see, insulin, which is the hormone that grabs all that sugar and escorts it into the cells, insulin is very, very much needed for the brain. Mm-hmm. And when your body becomes insulin resistant, so does your brain. And now the insulin can't get into the brain and can't do what it needs to do there. So there is a definite connection between this whole mechanism of carbohydrate metabolism and insulin resistance and all of that, and brain disorders like Alzheimer's.
This is fascinating, Johnny. We're going to have to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're talking to Johnny Bowden about inflammation.